Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Chai Pani Restaurant Group. This week on Meetin' 3, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture, luxury ice and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy, actually, for the bikes to sting upside down or slip or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meetin' 3, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So as you were just hearing, it certainly is the dead of winter right now. It's actually a very cold day today in Brooklyn, and it's actually still in the Lunar New Year. Chinese New Year is, you know, goes on for 7 days, so it'll still be the Year of the Pig celebrations for another couple days. So my guest today is a Chinese American, and she is laughing, but she was last here actually to talk about her first book maybe 5 years ago?
6 years ago.
6 years ago, and that was the Chinese Takeout Cookbook. So Gongxi Fatai, Diana Kwan.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. And your new book, okay, the follow-up. It is a cold day, as I was saying, but you will be warmed by it. It is called Red Hot Kitchen. Classic Asian chili sauces from scratch and delicious dishes to make with them. So congrats.
Thank you.
So this tackles 9 sauces from China, Japan, Korea, what else? Thailand?
Mm-hmm. Indonesia.
Indonesia.
Yep.
And there's like a Hong Kong specific sauce.
Yep.
There's a Sichuan specific sauce. So a lot of sauces in here.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to ask you first and foremost, because you have recipes for the sauces themselves,
mm-hmm.
as well as dishes to make with them. So, and some of these things are like pretty amazing, like pretty intense, you know, like there's some simpler sauces like the Sichuan chili oil, which I've made before, but then you have gochujang,
mm-hmm. which
you ferment for a month or so.
Yeah, there's two versions of gochujang, actually. There's a version that is fermented, and mm-hmm. that takes about 2 months to get, you know, a good enough flavor. And then there's a quick and easy version that you do at home, and there's a really simple shortcut you can do with it.
Ah, very sneaky. I love having that option, because I actually wanted to ask you, why do you think people should... make chili sauces as opposed to buying the red tub of gochujang or the bottle of whatever?
Well, the biggest reason I have for making my own is I can always customize them to the ideal level of spiciness that I want. Like sometimes, you know, the gochujang that I get at the grocery store isn't spicy enough, or it's like a little bit too smoky and I want it a little bit more balanced. So it all depends on what kind of flavor you're mm-hmm. looking for. And the more you make it, the more you're able to tweak it to however you'd like. And it's also a cost thing too. Like for example, for something like XO sauce, a really good bottle of XO sauce can set you back like $70 US. Whereas if you make it at home, you can make just like a huge, huge jar of it for a fraction of the cost.
Ah, but one of those ingredients in XO sauce is the dried scallops, right?
Mm-hmm.
That pungent, fishy flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen dried scallops going for a crazy amount of money. Yeah. They run the gamut.
Yeah, right? It can cost like $100 a pound.
For fancy ones.
For fancy ones. But you don't, like, those big fancy ones are usually the ones that people give for presents, like most likely like wedding presents. That's like a status symbol in Hong Kong. But you can, when you're making the sauce, you don't need like the huge fancy ones. You can just get like shredded scallops or smaller scallops for like much more budget friendly price.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Because, you know, in this sauce, it's going to get mushed up with so many other things. It's not about the dried scallops.
It's not about, like, the look of it.
And those, I guess, $100 jars of XO sauce is, I guess, more of, like, a status thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can make our... You could make a $100 jar, I guess, if you wanted. But it's good, again, to be able
for $100, you can make many jars.
Yeah, you can customize. Yep. And also play around with it. Okay, we wanted to back up and talk about, in the beginning, in the introduction, you write about how you traveled throughout Asia when you were living in Beijing. And, you know, you said you grew up eating Cantonese food, which is not spicy.
No, not spicy at all.
Right. And so it was really when you went to Beijing that you really fell in love with, and I was intrigued by this, Sichuan food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Beijing is pretty far from Sichuan province.
It is.
But you write that it seemed like Beijingers subsisted on Sichuan food.
Yeah, so there isn't like really a really strong Beijing cuisine like there are in other parts of China. Like you have imperial cuisine, and then you have like the much homier stuff like really thick skin dumplings, really thick noodles, and those are like the basic like everyday eats. But a lot of times people don't subsist just on like dumplings and noodles. If you go to Beijing on any given street, there'll be just tons and tons of Sichuan restaurants because I think they really kind of just took Sichuan cuisine as their own. And it's really easy to find amazing Sichuan food in Beijing. And it's also like a capital, so it draws a lot of people from other provinces.
Wow. So when was this that you were living in Beijing?
I was there from 2007 to early like 2009.
Because I'm just trying to trace back because, you know, 15 years ago in New York City, Sichuan food wasn't quite the sensation that it is today. It was much, and now it's like, you know, Sichuan food is really taken on in the U.S. in general. So I'm wondering when that maybe happened in Beijing where it became really popular.
I'm not really sure. I'm going to guess it's sometime between like the mid 80s to like the mid 2000s was when it was before like Beijing wasn't that open to people that were from outside provinces. And then over time, because
they were big snobs or what?
Well, actually, like China was kind of really divided between people who lived in different provinces. So like even if you wanted to move to a different city or a different town within China, you had to apply for kind of like a visa almost. So you like you can't move around as freely as you can like the US.
Got it.
So but there was like a big construction boom in Beijing in like the 90s and 2000s, so a lot of people just flooded in.
Yeah. Okay. So then why Sichuan food? Why did that one become so popular? Cuz there's distinct cuisines from other places in Asia.
Yeah. And there are like various other regional cuisines in Beijing, but I think it's just because it's a cuisine that's very easy to make your own, and it's a little much more, I guess, friendly to palates that aren't used to spicy food but still want like bold flavors. Like I personally think it's a little bit more like beginner friendly than Hunan food, which is just like crazy spicy without with a little bit less balance than Sichuan food is, because you can like tweak the amount of sugar in Sichuan food to make it a little bit more palatable. You can, which is what they do in Shanghai, which is used to a little like more like sweeter flavors. And then in Beijing, you could like definitely tone it down a little. So the Sichuan food that you find in Beijing is a tiny bit more toned down than the Sichuan food you can find in like Chengdu. But it's definitely not as toned down as you can find in the U.S.
Ah, interesting. And then, of course, people from Hunan would be like, it's not spicy enough. It's not intense enough. But, what do you think about why did Sichuan food become so popular in the U.S.? Did it follow this trend or from Beijing, or it just on its own merits captivated people?
Yeah, I think it started becoming popular in the U.S. in like in New York in the 1970s or so. And there were a lot of Sichuan restaurants. There were a lot of Americanized Sichuan restaurants and then Americanized Hunan slash Sichuan restaurants. And it also goes back to how adaptable it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. And there's a balance, like you mentioned. It's not just spicy. It's also, there's sourness, vinegar involved. There's also mala.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's the Sichuan peppercorn.
Yep, which is addictive on its own.
Right. Yeah, so, okay, you have a really fun history of the chili pepper and not to be confused with Sichuan peppercorns.
Mm-hmm.
So how did peppers, chilies, that is.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get to Asia?
So chili peppers kind of originated in the Americas. I think like Mexico was a huge, huge part of it. And then also Brazil and like Bolivia, they were huge producers. And like during the age of like discovery, there were, you know, we all know Christopher Columbus and the other Portuguese explorers. He hit the Americas and thought he was in India, as we all know. And he thought that what he was seeing was pepper, like peppercorn pepper. And
very strange confusion.
So that's the distinction between like why we call them both chilies and peppers. Mm-hmm. And then he brought them back to Europe where they were kind of just used as like ornamental plants.
Because they were afraid of the
spiciness. They were just like, what is this? It's kind of pretty. Let's just like grow them.
Okay. Didn't quite take off there yet.
Didn't quite take off there. But then the Portuguese also went to Goa.
In India,
where the cuisine was already had its own like nice blend of spices, like cinnamon and cardamom. Mm. And the Goans actually like really took to chili peppers and started incorporating them into the cuisine. And then from there, Portuguese traders, like I think Indian traders, and then other European traders kind of brought kind of just took them around Southeast Asia and to China. And then I think the Portuguese brought them to Korea too. And this was like in the
1600s.
Yep.
Pretty recent. That's kind of amazing. And I love that, you know, people discovered the plant capsicum, if you will, or chilies for many different uses, not just flavoring things, but also to preserve, right? Mm-hmm. It helps to naturally preserve meats.
Yep.
And
it has like natural antimicrobial properties. So you can just make a chili sauce and then that'll last for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll help preserve your other foods too.
And it tastes really good. And it's easy to grow too, right? They grow prolifically.
Yeah.
So anyone who's grown a chili bush or two will hopefully find this book really fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, let's talk about how did you pick 9 sauces for this book?
So there are obviously a ton of different hot sauces from around Asia, and I didn't want to do kind of like an encyclopedia of them because that would just take like, you know, 10 years to do and just be volumes. So I wanted to focus on 9 that were used as both condiments and cooking ingredients.
Got it.
So within like, I guess, the sambal family, there are many, many, many different types of sambals.
What exactly is the sambal family?
So sambal is the hot sauce that is used mainly in Indonesia and Malaysia. And they have a lot of different varieties that are used as condiments. But sambal oleic, which is like kind of like the plainest one, is also used as a cooking ingredient. So you can use it in a lot of Indonesian and Malaysian dishes. And it's the one that's in the cookbook that's like one of the easiest to make.
Cool. I didn't know that because I always just buy the green cap rooster sambal.
Yep.
So that's like a constant in my fridge. So I would, why? Okay. I'm glad I know that. but this one is very different than, you know, many other sauces because it has that bright red flavor and that bright tangy flavor too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then a more blended version is the sriracha. Is that in the sambal family or am I wrong?
Sriracha comes from Thailand. It's like this coastal Thai town. And the one that was originally made there, I think it, like there was a woman who kind of marketed her own, and it became really popular from that Thai town. And I think it only started, she only started like marketing in like the 30s. So but the Thai version of sriracha is like, it's going to be a lot tangier than the one that we know in the U.S., and it's a little bit more watery. And then there was a Vietnamese immigrant from who arrived in California, David Tran, I think his name is.
Yeah.
And he started that sriracha company out of like a little storefront in L.A., and that became a huge business, and that's the sriracha that we know now.
Okay.
But so it's a little bit different.
Than the original sriracha.
Yeah.
And have you been to some of the places and tasted their version of sriracha? The OG, I guess,
version? Yeah, in Thailand you can find it pretty easily.
Do they also have the American-born rooster sriracha?
No. But they do like make, you know, like a lot of different restaurants in Thailand make their own like house hot sauces. So.
Wow. It's so amazing how ubiquitous that sauce has become in such a short time. And just like all these stories have a fairly, I mean, sort of recent, like, you know, origins. I just think it's so interesting that kimchi, which you have a great recipe for, is something we think of as red. But before there was chilies in Korea, kimchi was just...
It was just like a fermented cabbage.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like sauerkraut.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and they still do have that. You can get that.
Yeah.
But it's not quite as fun.
Yeah. And I don't know where, you know, Korean cuisine would be now these days without chili peppers.
Yeah. With all that red. Oh my gosh. We're going to talk about more of these sauces and the recipes right after a quick little commercial break.
This episode is brought to you by Chai Pani Restaurant Group. From Bombay to Buncombe and Asheville to Atlanta, Chai Pani has extended the love of food, culinary experience, and storytelling to the Southeast. Founded by Meherwani and Molly Irani, Chai Pani Restaurant Group includes two locations of Chai Pani, plus MG Road Bar and Lounge, Botiwala, Buxton Hall Barbecue, and their new spice company, Spicewala. Learn more about Chai Pani and watch their documentary series, Cutting Chai, at ChaiPaniRestaurantGroup.com. That's Chaipani RestaurantGroup.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Michael Harlan Turkel, and I'm the host of The Food Scene here on HRN. This show explores the intersection of food, art, and design by talking to people who are inspired by these ideas. The show features food photographers, food stylists, interior designers, and so much more. All the players that make the world so visually delicious. You can find The Food Scene wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back chatting more with Diana Kwan, author of her latest book, which is Red Hot Kitchen. Hi, Diana.
Hi.
All right. So you've been teaching classes about, you know, cooking classes for 10 years or more. And they're typically on all sorts of different, like, niches of Chinese cooking or Asian, too. So why did you come up with this idea? Like, why just focus on spicy foods and sauces from all around Asia for this book?
The short answer, I guess, is that I've, you know, offered a ton of different classes over the years, but I found that the ones that get like people the most excited are the ones that really feature like bold, spicy flavors. So even in like the dumpling classes that I make, we do a Sichuan wonton dish that people kind of just like go crazy for. And it's like not usually a dish that you find in dumpling making classes, but once people taste the sauce, they're like, oh my God. So,
That's amazing. Cause, once you make the wontons, then it's all just all about the sauce that makes it.
Yeah.
Because the wonton is normal.
Yeah, the wonton is just normal. Like, I didn't want to just do, like, the wonton soup.
As in, like, not spicy. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just so easy to do. And then, but it's not something that people normally would think to make for themselves at home.
Right,
but I wanted to, like, introduce people to that.
So, okay, that's on the cover of this book. So it does look amazing. It has your chili oil, mm-hmm. which can you like briefly describe how to make this?
Yeah. So the oil itself, you can, the Sichuan chili oil, you kind of heat oil in a pot for like a few minutes until it's just very hot.
Neutral veg oil.
Yeah, like a high temperature cooking oil. Mm-hmm. And then you take it off the stove and you put in a whole bunch of like crushed red chilies along with spices like star anise and cinnamon. And you can throw in like a bay leaf too and cloves and then kind of just let it sit. And then the oil is infused with like all these different like chili flavors and then the aromas from the other spices. And that is like a very shelf-stable chili oil and that you could just like leave for like up to a year. And then you just mix in some like soy sauce, some vinegar, a little bit of like minced garlic.
For your dumplings. Yeah,
for the sauce.
Got it.
And then like Sichuan pepper too. And then you just coat it over your wontons.
Oh, I'm so hungry right now. But that oil that you're mentioning, it's like mm-hmm. an infusion. Would mm-hmm. you could also strain out the chunky stuff, like the spices.
You can also strain out the chunky stuff, but you don't really want to. Like, if you guys have ever had like lao gan ma before,
which is
Sichuan chili crisp that's super popular in the U.S., this is like a very similar homemade version.
We had Anita Lowe on the show a couple months ago, and she brought up lao gan ma in her book too, and she just gushed about it first. So yes, we love lao gan ma. So is that a chili oil type sauce?
Yeah, it's chili. It's like a really, really chunky, crispy.
So you can
chili
do
oil.
That using mm-hmm. your recipe.
Yep.
And then just maybe straining out the oil.
Yeah.
And then you could have the separate oil, sort mm-hmm. of like this thing that I'm looking at on this table here at Roberta's, that they have this red infused oil that you can drizzle on your pizza.
Yeah. So it just depends on whether you want like chunky, crispy stuff on your food or just like a plain chili oil.
And as you mentioned in the beginning, you can tweak things to your own taste. So you can put other stuff in it here too.
Mm-hmm.
Any suggestions? Because I didn't know about the cinnamon. Mm-hmm. You had star anise. And you also had cloves or something?
Cloves, yeah.
Cloves. Yeah, I didn't think of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else I could put?
You can also like switch out the Sichuan pepper for like green Sichuan pepper, which kind of has like this, you know, very sharp numbness.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's like
stronger.
A little bit sharper. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, my Sichuan peppercorns are red,
mm-hmm.
so it's milder.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just like dreaming of making my next version. all right. So I love how you have recipes in here that are not just, you mentioned your wonton recipe, really classic things to make with and pair with these sauces.
Mm-hmm.
But you have some unexpected ones too, and they're not always Asian recipes like this. XO sauce pizza?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the great thing about XO sauce is that even though it takes like a little bit longer to make than the other sauces, like once you have this like umami like packed jar, you don't really need that much extra when you go and when you make things. So I make like a flatbread pizza by just like baking it, like slathering over with like XO sauce and some like crispy shallots and Brussels sprouts. Mm. And it's like a really good, like, you know, impromptu pizza.
Fun. Is that your own invention?
Yeah. And I should also mention that even though the traditional XO sauce has like shrimp and scallops and bacon, I also have a vegan XO sauce in there that has like shiitake mushrooms and shallots, and it's a really
garlic.
Good, yeah, and it's like very umami rich as well.
Cool. I love it. Yeah, that's the one sauce that is traditionally in this book not quite vegetarian friendly.
Yeah.
is there a nam? What was
there? There's a vegan nam prik pao as well.
So that's a really pasty Thai sauce.
Yeah, and that
right?
traditionally has fish sauce in it,
mm-hmm.
Which definitely has like this umami pungency.
That's one that I've never made because it seems to have a lot of ingredients in it that mm-hmm. you would typically or traditionally pound in a mortar and pestle.
Yeah.
Do you do that yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You do?
I do. well, if I'm feeling like I need to, I can like skip the gym that day. I could just like pound the sauce.
If you're feeling angry at someone that day.
But you can also just like throw it in a food processor too, which is traditional, but it saves you some, you know,
there's
arm strength.
There's a lot of stuff in there. I love it. And then we didn't talk about Thai red curry paste, which you have here too.
Yep.
Another one of those things I find tough to get my head around.
That you can also pound.
You can also pound or not.
Yeah.
I love it. And then you have this wonderful, I mean, I need to make this tonight, Thai red curry coconut mussels dish.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorites. And it's so easy to make too.
I know. I love how like just having these sauces on hand means that you can make just, you know, just add a dab and then you have... You're set to go with so many things. Mm-hmm. Okay, one sauce in here is green, and that's the yuzu koshu.
Yes.
Kosho. So this means yuzu, the citrus, and then kosho means chili in Japanese?
So yuzu kosho is also just one of these sauces that is... it kind of like XO sauce. It's very unique in that it comes from a cuisine that is not traditionally known for having spicy food. Mm-hmm. So, and it's one of the ones in this book that you mentioned that uses green chilies. And then in Japan, normally you would use the yuzu fruit, which you can't really find here. But you can find, you can use Meyer lemons and limes, a combination of those two, to get the juice. Or you can use store-bought yuzu juice.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes great on Japanese food, but because it also has green chilies, it also, I found, works really great on Mexican food.
I had no idea it was so easy, too. So you take the zest and the juice and chilies.
Yes.
And you blend it.
Yeah. Or pound it together.
Okay. Or pound it again. I love it. And then, okay, so why did... So Japan doesn't really have much spicy food.
Mm-hmm.
How did this one and where in Japan did this come from?
So it came from an area that actually did a lot of trading with Southeast Asia, so it actually ended up getting a lot of like, they got like green chilies as a trade. So it became just really popular in this area.
Mm.
And they started like incorporating it into like udon soup. And it was served over like fish. It would be served over chicken. So
I find it really interesting that even though chilies have really spread throughout the world, especially in places like Korea, China, North, South, Japan seems to be a holdout for chili peppers, with the exception of this, like, yuzu kosho.
But we know from, like, wasabi that they're not, you know, opposed to strong, strong flavors.
Sure. I don't know. It's interesting. But this one sauce is definitely spicy, and you can adjust the levels of which you can just have yuzu paste, too, if you don't even like
it.
But that would be no fun. Diana, I know that you traveled a little bit for this book in addition to, you know, having lived there in the early aughts or whenever that was, and traveling then. What did you discover? Like, what was one of the things that, like, you're just like, yes, I have to put this in my book?
Before, when I was like coming up with the idea of the book, I had like all these different like Thai chili sauces in mind, but I didn't really like think of Chinese sauces as much, like other than like Sichuan chili oil. But then I remembered that that XO sauce was like super, super, super popular in Hong Kong. And it's also unusual. So when I was in Hong Kong, I was like tasting all these different varieties and I was like, oh, yeah, that could be something that would be great to incorporate.
Yeah.
And it's one of those sauces that people make so differently depending on the restaurant and the household and whoever's like making it to sell to. And there's like artisanal suppliers in Hong Kong that would make them out of like, they would make like vegan versions, they would make like mangosteen versions, like they would kind of go crazy.
Yeah, because there's a little sweetness in there. And certainly the dried, you know, garlic and onion and shallot or whatever would give it a little sweetness too and rounder flavors. Do you think that XO sauce is something that people are appreciating in your classes? It's less known than some of the others.
I actually haven't taught XO sauce in a class yet, but I'm doing a lecture at the Brooklyn Brainery on February 20th, and that will be like a chili text chili lecture and tasting, and that will be one of the sauces I'll have, like, that'll have people taste.
Oh, cool. And are you going to demo them, or it's like more of a talk and then show and
yeah,
taste?
It'll be more of a talk and show, because the making it is a little bit intensive.
Well, yeah, you could pound on stage. It might be fun. Okay, so that's coming up February 20th?
Yes.
Where else, what other classes you got coming up?
I have a whole bunch coming up. There's going to be like the usual like wonton dumpling classes. There'll be a Sichuan class. There'll be vegan Chinese cooking. And then I'm also doing a talk and tasting tomorrow at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill. So that'll be like a book launch.
Nice. Party. So where can everyone find your upcoming classes?
Like, you can go to brooklynbrainery.com and there'll be a list of upcoming classes. And then I also do private classes, and people can just email me for those too.
Okay. So we'll find you at Appetite for China for your own private fun chili classes. All right, I can't wait. Oh my goodness. Well, I hope everyone gets a hold of this book, and also if you're around Brooklyn, you can come to Books Are Magic tomorrow. Diana will be with Matt Rodbard, editor-in-chief of Taste, and that lecture, chili lecture, the Brainery. Well, I guess that's about all the time, but thank you so much, Diana.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I'm going to cook one of these things tonight. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.